Welcome back. As you're returning from your period of movement practice, I hope that it was supportive and you were able to find some of those moments of just goodness and resourcing in that practice. Movement can be such a powerful way of shifting the energy in our bodies and connecting to the present moment. So we'll continue our period of practice with a period of meditation. And again, I just want to encourage you as we practice our formal sitting practice to also allow yourself again to sense into any of those experiences, those moments, those sensations or sounds that are pleasant, that give the sense of maybe some stability or a sense of okayness or enjoyment, whatever that looks like for you. Sometimes, we really are just searching for something that feels kind of okay, kind of grounding. And sometimes we can tap into things that feel, delightful and delicious. And so, depending on whatever the range of your experience is today, I want to encourage you to just see if you can notice and take that in as we practice. And so, again, just taking your seat. And allowing your posture for this period of practice to be upright but comfortable. We really want to be not too tight, not too loose. Finding a way of placing the body that we feel comfortable, relaxed, alert. And as you settle into this posture, feeling the sensation of maybe your eyelids closed. Letting your jaw start to relax a little bit. Inviting the shoulders maybe to soften, to release if they've been holding some extra tension. Feeling the body making contact with the chair or the couch or the cushion. Noticing the sensation of your hands, maybe resting in your lap or by your side. Feeling your feet making contact with the floor. Allowing yourself to come into this physical sense of presence and embodied presence. And noticing if, as you sense into this embodied physical presence, noticing if there are any sensations in the body that you're experiencing as either pleasant or maybe neutral. And it may be something very simple, just like the sensation of your hands, the feeling of maybe tingling or energy or blood flow in the palms of your hands. It could be the sensation of your clothing touching your skin. Maybe the softness of fabric. Could be the movement of breath in the body. Or simply just the weightiness of our body resting, that sense of gravity, heaviness of our bones, that sense of stillness. I invite you to just take some time resting in whatever is pleasant or neutral here in the body. Letting yourself really savor that sensation, being fully present to it, curious, and receptive. The mind wanders off. It's totally okay, just bringing it back to that pleasant or neutral or supportive experience in the body. Just staying close to the sensation that offers a sense of groundedness or energy, interest or enjoyment, and allowing that to be the anchor for your gentle, open, curious attention. And as we continue to practice, you can stay with this resting in pleasant or neutral sensation in the body. Or you can begin to open your attention more widely, Letting yourself broaden towards noticing also the sounds all around you. Noticing sounds that are near to you. Perhaps even the sound of your own body, breathing or digestion, just a subtle movement, even here in stillness. And sounds in the room or the building. And those distant sounds coming from farther away. Letting yourself receive sound, knowing that you don't have to go out searching for it or grabbing at it, that it'll just arrive right at your ears. Noticing the way that sound is constantly changing. Each moment, sound arising and passing. The conceptual mind is quite active and assigning concepts and stories to the sounds that are arising around you. Seeing if you can allow those concepts, those stories just to arise if they arise and then pass, knowing you don't actually have to grab onto them. That it's enough just to let sound be sound and to be present and attentive to the arising and passing of sound all around us. Letting sound help bring us more fully into this present moment. In these final minutes of our practice, you may even open your attention even wider, letting it encompass all the sounds, all the sensations, all the thoughts and emotions that arise and pass in your system. Allowing your attention to be broad and open. Just receiving whatever is true in this moment for you. And then as you're ready, opening the eyes and bringing the experience of seeing into this broad awareness. And seeing if you can just allow yourself to be with what it's like to see without letting your attention, your awareness go way far away from your own experience, just being with sight. And then as you're ready, I'm just returning back into our circle here. Thank you for your practice. You know, I love working with both pleasant sensation in the body and sound because they can be so resourcing to the nervous system. You know, sometimes there's such a big emphasis on focusing on the breath as an object of meditation, which is great. But sometimes, depending on what's going on in our life, it can feel very contracted, very tight sometimes to just be with the breath. So there are these other ways of being with the present moment. You know, we can take in what's pleasant and interesting in the body. Sometimes, you know, you notice the sensation of the hands and it's like, wow, there's a lot going on in those hands. I wouldn't have thought in my day-to-day life, but you know, here they are. And there's warmth and energy and sensation that can help us find a place to really rest. And similarly with sound. And, you know, this is part of what I've been sitting with a lot this week. And I'm really happy to offer to you all today this sense of our own capacity in our practice to create islands of experience. Where there is a sense of groundedness, there's a sense of maybe safety, there's a sense of some resourcing, some enjoyment. Because part of what we're doing is really creating a refuge for ourselves and, of course, for others as well through this practice. You know, each one of us, no matter where we are in the world, no matter our history, no matter our gender or our class or our race or sexuality, each one of us has this basic human need for safety, for stability, to find refuge in one way or another. You know, this is at the absolute heart of Dharma practice. It's the foundation of what we're doing here. One of my earliest encounters with the Dharma was actually through the precepts, which, for those who aren't familiar with the precepts, they're a set of five ethical guidelines, ways that we can live our lives to not harm ourselves and not harm other beings. It was in a book by Thich Nhat Hanh. And while I'd already been at this time, I was probably around 18, and I'd already been engaging in some different, contemplative practices, attempting meditation, but not receiving Buddhist teachings yet. This was at a time where you couldn't so easily Google, how do I meditate? Well, Google didn't exist. So there's that. I had no idea that reading these precepts would be such a profound doorway into the Dharma, into my understanding of what it means both to seek refuge and to be a refuge. And Carlita just popped the resource document into the chat. I have included a link that has one of Thich Nhat Hanh's ways of framing the five precepts that I so invite you later on to check out, because it's very powerful. And these five guidelines, these precepts, they're quite simple. They revolve around not killing or harming other beings, being careful with our speech, not lying, not speaking really harshly, not misusing our sexuality in a way that hurts ourselves or hurts other beings, not stealing or not taking what isn't really freely offered, and then refraining from substances that would impair our judgment in such a way that we'd be much more likely to cause harm in all of these different ways. And reading the precepts, and particularly the rationale behind them, that we follow these guidelines as a way to minimize harm, minimize suffering for ourselves, for others, it really rocked me. As an 18-year-old, and if you can think back to that age, or if you have loved ones maybe who are that age right now, there's a lot of churn and angst and suffering that happens when you're, 16, 17, 18. You probably can relate or remember what it felt like, because you don't have to really live very long to see the kind of harshness and cruelty that people can enact on one another or themselves. By the time we're young adults, we probably have a sense, even if our life has been quite smooth up until that point, we already have a sense of what it is to maybe not feel safe or not feel accepted, and not feel like we have a great sense of refuge. And in our hearts, usually at that age, we also have a really solid sense that it doesn't have to be that way. That it could be better. We could treat each other better. We could treat ourselves better. I think a lot of the time this is part of that kind of young adult, adolescent time period, the angst and the sort of split that happens between what we really know in our hearts to be true, that kindness matters, that safety matters, that we're all worthy, worthwhile beings, and then to witness, the outside world and what can happen there. And so at that age, really seeing this framing of the precepts around creating care, creating safety as like a foundational part of a spiritual practice, it struck such a deep chord in my heart. I could really viscerally feel and envision what was possible if we lived in a community where that type of care was expressed, where we actually prioritized and held a commitment to doing things in a way that wouldn't cause harm. As a young person reading those precepts, it was like, wow, if people just did these things, probably 75 or 80% of the pain I'd experienced in my life wouldn't have happened. That's major. And so learning about this really, it was profound for me. In a lot of ways, it was such a doorway into this sense of refuge, this sense of sila, which we talk about as ethics or virtue. In the Pali language, it became such a doorway into the Dharma. And it was really an incredible inspiration for my continuing on that path. This little kernel of a vision of what was possible if we just oriented towards not harming. And, I can still remember what it felt like to read that book, to read those precepts. I remember where I was sitting. I remember the light coming in through the windows. It just stuck with me. And, many years later, here at Spirit Rock, actually, for a long time, I had the good fortune to be a mentor during many different meditation retreats for teenagers. And like any retreat, we begin actually by taking these five precepts, committing not to harm in these different ways. And, as you might imagine, the precepts when you're introducing them to a group of room full of teenagers who are new maybe to retreat practice, they're met with a little bit of skepticism at first. Teens are testing boundaries and they're exploring, and that's part of their developmental process. So telling them, okay, we're all going to be together and you're going to commit to not flirting. You're going to commit to not gossiping. You're going to commit to not excluding one another in the ways that can happen so often. At first there's often a little sense of a little sense of pushback, a little sense of boundary testing. And then almost immediately after, as we start to explain why, there's this huge sense of relief and spaciousness. Because they totally get the kind of harm that that sort of carelessness can cause. And they see that we're actually all responsible for creating a space where we can have the safety needed to go deeply into practice, into learning about ourselves. And, at the end of every retreat, we would always have a big dance party. It was part of kind of the culmination of the retreat. And, all the adults would stay around. The container would continue to be held with following the precepts. And it was so beautiful because, these retreats for teens, they really are kind of a combination of silent retreat, summer camp, and group therapy. And there's so much that gets known and revealed and tended to during those times. It's really, really big. And for many of these young people, it's the first time that they've ever really had the space to be with themselves in that kind of way, you know, away from devices, away from family, away from the external pressures of school. And so it always felt like such an incredible celebration. These, you know, wonderful young people just, you know, after a week of much silence, just letting loose and dancing and yeah, really reveling. And I don't think I'll ever forget, you know, a young woman during one of these dance parties coming up to me. And she was probably 15 or 16 at the time, pretty young. And she showed up with this like joy and amazement and this sort of spark of awe. You could see in her eyes, you could really feel it in her presence. And she took me aside and she shared with me that it was the first time that she'd ever been able to go to a dance or a party and not be subjected to unwanted sexual attention, to peer pressure, to all of these different things that she was so used to encountering all the time. And she looked at me and she told me that she felt so free. So free. This is what we're doing here. This is it. Right? We're creating little islands of refuge so that that freedom can actually reveal itself. And often, you know, like the case of this young woman, for better or for worse, we really only do know that value of refuge, of safety, of goodness when we've experienced its opposite. We start to see how important that is, how important it is to feel that sense of freedom, that sense of safety, because we know what it feels like to feel otherwise. Naomi Shihab Nye, who's an American poet, actually with American and Palestinian parents. She puts it really beautifully in her poem, Kindness. She writes, "Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things and feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it's only kindness that makes sense anymore. only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It's I you've been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. And each one of us, through our practice, is reorienting towards this kindness. And it's a radical reorientation. This turning towards safety, wholeness, peace. This commitment to fostering that same sense of freedom, it's the bedrock that we all stand upon. Whether we're sitting on our cushion here in meditation, or we're out in the world, working or taking care of our family, or being of service in our community. But it's so easy also to get pulled off course, And so much of the time in our culture, we're orienting in a way that's actually counter to our efforts of creating safety, creating freedom. And so much of our own wounding, our own confusion, our own bias or reactivity can also get in the way. There's this really lovely story that I imagine some of you have heard, that in 1957 in Thailand, there was a monastery that was in the process of relocating. And so the monks, in this moving process, they were taking all the furniture, all the statues, they were taking everything from this old monastery into the new space that they would be using. And so one day they were moving this giant clay Buddha. It was, huge out in the courtyard. And as they were moving the clay Buddha, they noticed that the clay actually had some cracks in it, and it looked almost as if there was this beautiful golden light just sort of emanating from the clay Buddha. And so one of the monks got a little bit closer and he brought a chisel with him and he just started tapping away at the clay to see what was going on underneath that crack. And in the process, they discovered that this giant clay Buddha was actually made from solid gold. Totally different than what they thought. And the belief is that actually, hundreds of years prior, the monks in that monastery had actually covered the Buddha in clay because there was an invading army and they wanted to protect the precious Buddha statue from being taken. And so they covered it over and they made it less appealing looking and they just, covered it over with this intent to protect. And the understanding is that the army came and they killed all the monks, but they didn't discover the Buddha. And so the knowledge of the gold Buddha was lost with the lives of the monks in this monastery. And so for years and years and years, the clay Buddha remained all the while, having solid gold deep within, this effort to protect. And this is really what happens to each one of us. Just in the process of living, we cover over or we compromise parts of ourselves, of our own goodness, our own sincere desire for safety or well-being. And all the time, it's in an effort to protect ourselves. I think of one young man I knew who grew he was a young gay man and grew up in a community that was not accepting. And he developed this cutting, sarcastic sense of humor that he could bring to pretty much anything. And it was an amazing defense mechanism. It really, really worked for him in so many ways. But it also prevented people from getting close to him and really getting to know him. Because there was always some kind of a deflecting joke or a sarcastic remark rather than really showing his authentic experience, And we all do this in some way. Things get confused and muddled in our efforts to protect ourselves, in our efforts to stay safe. We go out thinking that we're looking for success or popularity or wealth or status or belonging in this effort to be safe, be well. At its core, this is all about an attempt to find a stable, solid place of refuge. But we so often find that when we go searching out these things, we don't actually find the refuge that we're really looking for. All too often, those habits, those defense mechanisms that we've put in place to protect ourselves don't always serve their intended purpose. Or maybe they do for a while, and then they don't anymore. Because oftentimes we're looking for a reliable refuge in all the wrong places. And so many of us, I would bet that many of you turned towards meditation, turned towards the Dharma when you started to recognize that truth. That there was not such a reliable refuge in all of these external things. And that it would probably be best to turn towards creating refuge inside, within ourselves. The etymology of the word refuge actually comes from Latin. There's two root words. One is re, which means back, and fugere, which can be translated as flee, to flee, or to run away. So instead of running towards all of these false refuges, the things that we think will protect us, but actually don't, we're turning back. We're running in the opposite direction back to ourselves. Back to the truth, back to our commitments to living in a way that minimizes harm and really cultivates freedom. Back to, in some ways, that sort of fundamental sense of care and innocence that, many of us innately have as young people. And the beauty of this is that we do have agency in going back, in taking refuge, in practicing so that we can be a refuge to ourselves and to others. We have the knowledge of the Dharma. We understand cause and effect. We have all of these tools in our practice, and that gives us a lot of power. The world can feel incredibly overwhelming at times. And I would wager that many of us have felt quite overwhelmed by the world over these last days and weeks. But each of us through this practice does have the capacity to begin to create islands of refuge in our minds and hearts, but also in our families, with our friends, in our workplaces, and hopefully rippling outwards into the world. There's a really beautiful quote that Tanisara Bhikkhu, who's a monastic teacher, scholar, writes about this. The fact that we actually have this understanding of cause and effect, that our actions matter, which in Buddhism, we talk about a lot of the time in terms of karma or kamma. So, Tanisara Bhikkhu writes, the role that kamma, so basically cause and effect, plays in awakening is empowering. It means that what each of us does, says, and thinks does matter. This in opposition to the sense of futility that can come from reading, say, world history, geology, or astronomy, or I would also say, reading the news can elicit this too. Realizing the fleeting nature of the entire human enterprise. And he says, awakening lets us see that the choices we make in each moment of our lives are real and that they produce real consequences. The fact that we're empowered also means that we are responsible for our experiences. We're not strangers in a strange land. We have formed and are continuing to form the world we experience. And I love that part. The fact that we are empowered also means that we're responsible for our experiences. We're not strangers in a strange land. We have formed and are continuing to form the world we experience. And this is an incredibly powerful take on our place in the world, on the agency that we do have, even as, small beings in a complex system. And it gets right to the heart of why cultivating that sense of refuge is really important. If we know that every word, every action, every thought that we have is part of a rippling outwards of cause and effect, then we also have tremendous power to cultivate safety, to cultivate refuge, to cultivate freedom for ourselves and for other beings. And what this is turning towards ourselves, turning towards our practice, and recognizing the places where healing is needed, where maybe there's some confusion or some craving or greed or some aversion or hatred. And beginning to seed an intention to cultivate the wisdom and the compassion that's required to respond appropriately. We can endeavor slowly, gently, with great kindness and patience, because this does take time, to begin to just remove all those layers of clay and dust that accumulate around our own hearts, so that their true nature can start to shine forward in the same way that the golden Buddha did. We can run home, seek refuge, and really tend to that innate capacity to care, that compassion, that goodness that does live within each one of us. We can create a refuge for just one moment or one day or one person. But every time we do this, we're opening a doorway to a deeper sense of truth, a deeper sense of refuge, a deeper connection to the Dharma for ourselves and also for other beings. And so I hope that this supports you as we move forward the days and weeks ahead in our lives. And I really sincerely wish each one of you moments of that refuge, moments of that safety and the freedom that comes from safety. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.